On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Now, you've been hearing a lot about the plan to escape from the COVID restrictions, the slow plan to try and bring life back to normal. And you've been hearing a lot about the Delta variant, what was previously known as the Indian variant before the WHO issued its new guidance on how those variants are to be named this week. You'll have heard a lot of concern about the degree to which it's now spreading in Britain, and particularly in some areas of Northern England and also in some parts of Scotland. Now, the British Secretary for Health, Matt Hancock, was speaking on the Andrew Marr programme this morning, and he was talking about how, although there is a rise in coronavirus cases as a result of this Delta variant, that it isn't necessarily resulting in an increase in people in hospital.
Thankfully, that link, which was absolutely rock solid, now is, I've said it, severed but not broken. There are some people in hospital who've been double vaccinated, but very few. And critically, those who are double vaccinated also appear to be, even if they're in hospital, appear to be less seriously ill. So, you know, the vaccine is working and it is our way through it, but the new variant, because it's more transmissible, is obviously making that calculation harder. And we'll look at the data for another week and then make a judgment.
So that's Matt Hancock talking about the what he's now calling the decoupling or detachment to some degree between COVID-19 cases in Britain, particularly in light of the Delta variant. He also said, by the way, the British government does still have an open mind about whether the final reopening on June the 21st will go ahead. He pointed out that the language has always been not before June the 21st, but there is a prospect of some of the larger reopenings in England being deferred until into July, which is already going to be the case in Scotland and in Wales. Let's catch up with John Byrne Murdoch, who's a data visualization journalist with the Financial Times. John, thanks very much again for joining us this Sunday lunchtime. Always appreciate your time. You, as people will know, if people are regular listeners to the programme, you do a lot of work in trying to compare and contrast the situation around the world, comparing the countries that are now beginning to relax all of their restrictions entirely and to map the outbreak of some of these new variants. Give us a global overview, first of all, of just how prominent this Delta variant is around the world.
This is an interesting one because obviously the UK has a sort of long-standing and strong relationship, as it were, with India, and so there have probably been more cases of the Delta variant imported into the UK than any other country over the last couple of months. Now, it is that being said, it's very tricky to know exactly how prevalent each of these variants is around the world because different countries do very, very different amounts of the genetic sequencing, which is what tells us which variants are where. So for example, the UK sequences about 2 out of every 5 cases that are detected in the country, whereas in somewhere like the United States, it's only 1 out of every 25, and worldwide it's more like 1 out of 200. So in a sense, that any variant is always more likely to be detected in the UK than elsewhere, just because the UK is looking harder for them. But having said that, I think it is fairly clear at the moment that aside from India itself, of course, the UK is, in terms of Western countries, definitely the country that has most of this variant circulating. Other Asian countries, it's believed to be quite widespread. And there is believed to be some of it in the US and some European countries, although at lower levels. But the UK, in terms of Western countries, would have the highest prevalence at the moment, we believe.
Given the amount of supervision that you do on trends around the world, and particularly in some of the Western European countries that are a little bit more rigorous about reporting the stats, is there anything in your mind that would lead you to think that there is a spread of this elsewhere because of how more quickly it spreads and how that might be behind any surges anywhere in the world?
I do think it's just hard to say. Like, Germany and France have picked up not tiny, but not huge numbers of cases of the Delta variant as well. Another of the difficulties here is it's hard to know on the surface whether these cases are from sort of exclusively from travellers who are then quarantining, or whether they've spread into the community. So it's probable that there are cases elsewhere in Europe, but there's nothing at the moment at the level that the UK is, or even that the UK was a month ago. So yeah, I think it's just one that everyone's keeping an eye on.
There's been different advice and some maybe conflicting figures that have come out about just how much more quickly this spreads relative to the previously known Kent variant, which is now the Alpha variant in the official WHO parlance. What's your best take, given the way in which it's spreading around the world? How much more quickly is this spread relative to the others?
Yeah, so I think the preponderance of evidence at the moment suggests roughly 50% more transmissible. So if you imagine sort of two rooms with people in them, and in one of them it's the Alpha UK variant, and the other it's the Delta variant from India, you would get a sort of 50% more people infected in the room with the Delta variant. So that's based on the latest data from Public Health England, which again is probably doing more analysis on this than any other country in the world. And a few other data points would corroborate that as well. So yeah, about 50% more transmissible than the one that took over the UK and other countries a few months ago.
Even though there's been some suggestions, and I think there were some unnamed English health sources in the last couple of days who were saying that it might in fact be twice as infectious as the Alpha variant.
Yeah, and look, the tricky thing with measuring this stuff is there are so many different factors to take into account. So there's even the basic number of whether it's 50% or 70% more transmissible, that can still come from lots of different factors. So part of it may come from some amount of immune escape that variant is capable of doing. Part of it will be just that it does spread more easily between people. Part of it could even be that the places where it is spreading at the moment, the conditions are a bit more favorable. So whether that means fewer people vaccinated or people living in more crowded accommodation and that kind of thing. So it's everyone's working to tease apart the different factors and therefore sort of what this means for the weeks and months to come. But the most solid figure at the moment, I think, is that 50% number.
Okay. And then to what degree can we tell, and this again might be influenced by the fact that the genomic sequencing is possibly stronger in the countries that have a more advanced vaccine rollout. How much more infectious is it, particularly among the younger generations? Because if they are going to be the bottom of the queue in a lot of countries for getting a jab, or indeed some people who are underage who may not ever get a jab based on current plans, how much more infectious is it among those categories in particular?
I think that again is a one where it's very difficult to tease out the difference between what is caused by the variant, the sort of biology and the chemistry of the variant, versus what is caused by the way that people are interacting at the moment. So in the UK, for example, we obviously had schools open now for a couple of months, whereas most people who can are still working from home. So you've got a lot more mixing in close contact in schools than in other areas. So therefore, whatever variant was circulating, we would probably be seeing more spread in schools. Now, again, that doesn't mean it's not possible that the variant inherently spreads more among young people. That's certainly a possibility. But as I say, it's just teasing apart the difference between what's caused by the variant and what's caused by the environment that is tricky. So we do know that cases among young people in the UK, in these hotspots like the northwest of England, cases have got much higher among young people. They've often passed any previous peak for the young people, which they haven't done for older adults. So again, possible that that's because of the actual properties, or possible that that's just because we've got hundreds of thousands of kids mixing in close environments in schools.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, in particular in England, because of how much more aggressive the reopening has been with hospitality back, and that really the last thing is really sort of outdoor crowds. That's the last main thing to bridge. There's been an awful lot written, and I know that there was that landmark study published by Public Health England a couple of weeks ago about how this new Delta variant responds to different vaccines. And in particular, there was a lot of fretting about the fact that if you've only got one dose of AstraZeneca, that it might only provide you with about 33% protection from this Delta variant, at least from significant illness as a result of it. One question that I haven't seen answered, and I don't know whether you have an answer to this, John, either from England or from trends anywhere else in the world, is how much it's affected by how recent your first dose was. In other words, do you have more protection a fortnight after your first AstraZeneca dose, or might there be more protection if it's 2 months after your first dose, or is there any kind of guidance at all on whether there's a sliding scale there?
So I've not seen a huge amount of research done on this, because again, the tricky thing is this: the Delta variant is relatively new to the UK, and that's where really all of this analysis is being done. But it's as with the second dose, the first week or two after you've been vaccinated is when that immune response is still building. So the response is going to be, the protection level is going to be higher after sort of 2 or 3 weeks than it was in those first few days after you got jabbed. But yeah, exactly how that varies across the period between the two doses, I think, hasn't been established yet. But as you said, the key thing is protection after a second dose, whether that's of Pfizer or AstraZeneca, or we believe likely Moderna as well, that is much higher after that second dose. So the tricky sort of trade-off for governments now is, well, we've had evidence for some time showing that if you space out the two doses, you get a stronger immune response from that second dose. But now that we know that the protection after one dose is much lower than after two, it's that question of, okay, well, does that mean we need to shorten the gap between the doses in order to get that second dose boost of whatever level?
Yeah, but because I think that was the one major takeaway that we possibly had the last time that we spoke to you. We were discussing whether Ireland should phase out the space out the two Pfizer doses so that more people could have some protection, even if it meant some people having to wait longer for their second one. And Ireland indeed has gone the opposite direction now, where previously it was between 12 and 16 weeks between AstraZeneca doses, and now we're trying to shorten it down to 8, which is the manufacturer spec. Are there many other countries that are going down that route now who are fretting about the vulnerability of people who've only had one dose and who are trying to aggressively catch up for lost time now?
So I can't point to specific examples there, but my understanding is that, yeah, there are now more countries starting to consider shortening the dose to 8 weeks, for example, because of that new knowledge that with new variants, the second dose is likely to be the critical one.
How much of a threat are variants ongoing? And, you know, there are four officially recognised variants of concern, but there will be a lot of people who are fretting now about the prospect that just as soon as we manage to reach something that's kind of approaching herd immunity, that some other new hyper-spreading variant will come along that will undermine the whole thing. I mean, I don't want to try and alarm people or to put them off on the Sunday of what's a holiday weekend over here in Ireland, but, you know, can we be confident that at some point that we ever will reach end point on this, so that there aren't just going to be a whole new series of new variants that arise from some corner of the world that might undermine the science to date?
Yeah, I think, look, my sense of this is that it's not going to be a sort of black and white, we were in the COVID era and now we're not in the COVID era. There's not going to be a sort of clear binary divide like that. But what will instead happen is that over the coming months, we will get used to the fact that every once in a while there will be a story of a new variant that's been detected somewhere in the world, and that it may have some properties that make it more risky, but that it's unlikely that any of these are going to take us back to square one. But equally, we're not going to just COVID variant stories, I don't think, are going to completely die away. And I think we can already sort of see that, because there are, you know, we're hearing stories about the variant that has been linked to Nepal, for example, which at the moment there are only very, very small numbers of that, and there's very little understanding of what impact it would have. But we're still getting those stories because we know that worst case scenario these things can be a problem. I think the other thing to bear in mind is, to the extent that we start seeing more variants that are especially dangerous, we know that it's possible to create booster vaccines that are tailored especially to deal with those variants. So I think, yeah, this is not going to go away completely, but I think the way we think about these stories will be less in terms of this sort of immediate acute threat to what's going on in any given country, and more in a sense of like, okay, right, there's this new thing, and that means maybe we'll all get another jab in a couple of months, and it will become just something we live with rather than something that causes huge alarm in each time.
Yeah, this kind of rolling defence. I know that last question might have been slightly alarmist, so then on a slightly more optimistic note, you might remind people, because we've seen so much coverage about how much or how little protection you get from one dose, it might be worth reminding people how much protection they get when they've had both of their doses.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is the single main takeaway to keep in mind here, is that after two doses of either Pfizer or AstraZeneca, there's very little drop off in protection compared to what we've been seeing with the Alpha/UK variant for some months now. So if you rewind the clock 2 months to when we thought, you know, everything's going pretty well, numbers are coming down, The data we have now shows that after two doses, that takeaway, that conclusion is largely unchanged. So what's really changed in the last month is that people who are not yet fully vaccinated or even partially vaccinated are now more vulnerable to this variant. But for people who've had two doses, whether we're talking to you in February, March 2021 or today in June 2021, the story is largely the same, which is that you get that second dose. A couple of weeks after that, you've got very strong protection from infection and likely even stronger protection from needing to go to hospital.
Just a couple of texts in from listeners with questions, and I appreciate that I'm kind of catching you blind on these, John, so I don't know whether you'll have any kind of anything to hand on these, but just a couple of questions that you might possibly know something about just because they've come in. Somebody has texted 53106 wondering about how much of an impact now there is on people now actively going to seek a second jab, or even people actively going to seek the first, and whether some of the hotspots that we've seen in England, like Bolton, have now seen people who were previously very passive, who thought they wouldn't get sick, who are now maybe rushing to try and get done. And does this maybe have a benefit in terms of increasing take-up?
Yeah, there was a sort of short-term rise in Bolton and then in Blackburn in the northwest of England as well, with a sort of push of vaccinations over a week or two in mid-May. I think that was partly probably individuals taking the initiative, but also local public health officials really going out and saying, let's make sure that anyone who's not protected, we get them that protection. So there have been signs of that, and I'm less sure at the national level, but even among people over 70 who've been eligible for this for months now, we are still seeing those numbers creep up. So there's definitely evidence that people, for whatever reason, are still going out to make sure they get that second jab.
Okay, and one more question from a listener just before I let you go again. Do you have any knowledge of any other countries that have adopted this mix and match approach? I presume what that listener means is the idea of giving somebody the first dose of one vaccine, but then deciding to give them a second one of a different dose in order to try and stimulate more of a viral response.
Off the top of my head, I'm not aware of that, but I do know that the scientific advice on this was that while that shouldn't be sort of the basic policy that countries aim for, that's not necessarily a bad option if that's the only option available.
Maybe it's the case that no country has kind of reached the point where they've got such an abundance of vaccines that they can afford to be a little bit more liberal like that.
Yeah, and look, I mean, the way most countries are doing this is quite straightforward. They're just saying, if we've got two doses of this thing, then that means one person. We give them one now, we give them one later. So we're not yet in a situation, I think, where countries are having to mix and match.
Yeah. By the way, how's Israel doing? Because Israel, we've stopped hearing so much about their vaccine response because of other things that's been going on over there. But they were the world leaders. They were streets ahead of anyone in trying to get the mass population taken care of. How is the situation over there now? Have they basically managed to go back to completely normal?
I'm still sort of reluctant to say completely normal anywhere, because there's always there are always slight nuances. I think in Israel there's still a fair amount of mask wearing, and of course, you know, whatever the rules are, people are still aware that there's a global pandemic going on, and there will always be some people being a bit more cautious. Mm. But yeah, Israel has done quite a fair amount of reopening. Large aspects of life have gone back to normal there, and I think because of their there's been much fewer imports of the Delta variant into Israel as well, which means that they've not had this bump in the road that the UK has had. So I think, yeah, progress in Israel is still going well, and they're well on their way to a sort of new normal, as it were. Well, old normal.
Sure. Whatever the new normal is going to look like, we might be looking there first. John, thank you for humouring us both with the pop quiz, with the unexpected topics, but also for just giving us your perceptions on how things are going, because I know it's been an exhausting ride for all of us, but you've been doing so much to try and keep track of different trends around the world and to try and make them coherent for those of us in certain corners. So I appreciate all of your work and appreciate your time again this lunchtime. That's John Byrne Murdoch, who's a senior data visualization journalist with the Financial Times, whose graphs you will definitely have seen at some point on the internet over the last 15 months.